we are going to start and we are going to allow members to ask questions again. Other members to find out this because you continue. I know that buses are arriving late. Like Mamu Ben, good morning. How are you? Very fine. The media people, good morning. How are you doing? Fine. We are dealing with the annual report, not the A400. I know you've been putting pressure for this type of question. Don't put David under pressure, man. Now you feel that you must raise this question. We are, as we have already been always saying, that question is an outstanding question that would be handled through the cabinet process. It's in front of cabinet, and cabinet must keep direction to that particular matter. In response to some of the improvement that was happening during question time. Good morning, Mrs. Molokai. Ellen, good morning.
Good morning, sir.
How are you?
I'm fine, sir.
Fine.
Okay.
Fine. You sent us a notice this morning. So I'm trying to circulate that notice to the members. That everybody must know that through communication has to be done through Ellen Molokai in the office of the ministry. We just want to emphasize she has given us a notice that gives all the details. So I wouldn't want us to go back to that question today. I just want us to make sure and clear that matter now that every communication will go through. Members, I must say that we do what we have agreed yesterday, that we will deal with the administration and its own sub-programs. And the head of that sub-administration is the Secretary of Defense, the Acting Secretary of Defense. So I'll give an opportunity for you to go to that question. All the questions that were raised yesterday, you were able to answer most of them in a satisfactory manner. I've interacted with members this morning. I don't hear them complaining about you not answering their questions. So we'll start from the Acting Secretary of Defense, and beyond that, we'll give an hour together for the Castle of Good Hope, and then we'll be finished for the day. If you work very well by 12 after 7, we should be out of this place, depending on how members are feeling about their different questions. But I will do our best to make sure that they get some satisfaction in their answers. Can I give you members an opportunity to shoot your own questions? Okay.
Chair, thank you, and thank you to the Secretary and your team from the Secretariat for being here this morning. I'd like to, rather than dealing with each sub-program in sequence, jump around a little bit today, and I'd like to start off with a question on acquisition services. When we were last in committee at Mandela Rhodes Place, the Secretary confirmed that in fact there was a report or reports into following investigations into Vistula, which I understand is a project to, or was a project to procure vehicles. Now, my understanding at that meeting was that the Secretary had undertaken to provide copies of those reports to this committee. And correct me if I'm wrong, Chair, so far as I'm aware, this committee is not yet in receipt of those reports. Now, the question is, when will this committee receive copies of the reports on the investigation into Project Vistula? That is the first question. Perhaps the Secretary could deal with that and other questions, and then I'd like to move into the question of defense supply chain governance.
The last time I'm the chairperson, and you are asking questions. Yes. Ask your questions. I'll give you two questions more so that you could. The other members are settling in.
Thank you, Chair. I'd like to then move on to the sub-program of defense supply chain governance. Mr. Zondi a permanent employee of the department, or is he a consultant to the department? I think this is an important question. I think that this committee ought to have sight of that contract. That's the first question. The second question is a question relating to Mr. Zondi. Now, procurement is a very sensitive business, and my understanding is that individuals who are employed in that department ought to be vetted by Defence Intelligence. My question has Mr. Zondi been vetted, and does he currently, is his vetting status active? In other words, has he been vetted, and is his vetting status active? If he has not been vetted, why has that not taken place? Chair, if you'd allow me to ask just a third question, which still relates to Mr. Zondi. If I take the secretary back to our meeting at Rhodes Mandela Place, again, there was an Mr. Zondi, I remind you, confirmed that he, in fact, did have other business interests, that those were had been declared to the appropriate authority, and it was my understanding that this committee would receive copies of those documents. Again, so far as I'm aware, this committee has not received those documents. Now, my question again is, when will we receive those documents?
Any other member got a question? Or would want to make a full one? If not, can I give over to you? The understanding is that you are answering those questions. The procurement people who are in the
Thank you, Chair. Honourable Member. With respect to when will the PCD receive the Stuller report, that must be cleared with the Minister before it's handed to the committee. I should state, however, that the previous, I think it was the third Parliament, the committee before you did deliberate on the matter. And I think there can be a retrieval of that record of those deliberations. That is the committee before this one, before the start of the new parliament, did deliberate on that matter. With respect to whether Mr. Zondi is on contract or permanent or what, the answer is yes, Mr. Zondi is a permanent employee of the Department of Defense, but he has a contract. So he is permanently employed as a member of the Department of Defense and does have a contract with a specific fixed term. With respect to what the vetting status is and whether that is active, I cannot confirm at this stage, but I do know that the process of vetting does take some time, depending also on the levels of classification for which a security clearance is required. So it is a matter that we can check. I cannot confirm now that it has an active status. As that process takes a bit of time. We do not have copies of the business interest of documents. Yeah, with respect to the business interest, we do not have that. Thank you.
Now, a follow-up question there on the last part would be like, he has promised that he's given it over to you as the necessary authority. So my impression on that is, are you saying now that he never submitted that type of report to you of his own interest? And the second one is, in consultation with the secretary here, who was part of the old committee,
report has never been submitted to the portfolio committee. She said the understanding was that it is a confidential report. It is a sensitive report of the Istuka, so it couldn't be submitted during that particular period. And in her own knowledge, it has not been submitted to Parliament at all. That's what she's reporting. She's the backbone of this committee, so she'd know more better about all the reports that have been outstanding between myself and the chairperson has been shared, and she's in the center of making sure that I receive all the reports that have been coming from the past. But that particular report, sensitive or not sensitive, it has not been submitted to the portfolio committee in Parliament. So maybe we should work on that one. The other aspect in relation to this matter of verification, I mean of vetting, I just want to know that while people are waiting for their vetting, do they then being allowed to be active in this type of work that you think that they're being vetted for? Is that a procedural thing that I'm interested in, that while they're waiting for your vetting, do they allow you to be active? Because from what Mr. Zodi was saying, he is on the procurement committees and every other aspect that are related to his work. Is that not inhibiting him when there's a delay in relation to vetting? I just wanted to know that, so that you could be able to rest assured that there's nothing there. But I must say also, in the budget process yesterday, which is an outside question, in the budget of yesterday, Minister has made a commitment that they are going to do an improvement in relation to the issues of how procurements are being handled within the department. So we'll have to take note of that, and between ourselves and the department here, we'll have to help about our own contribution of how can we improve the systems of the department around this particular issue, so that in the future it doesn't arise as a problem, but it does come to that we have made our own contribution, and when fact it's been banalized of how officials are having procurement were able to say that the defense has been able to make a contribution towards that particular thinking, and of how could we improve the environment around procurement. And in our drive, also partly of what came out yesterday in the budget, the minister has also submitted already to the portfolio committee issues that are related to cutting, so that you could be able to assist each other in cutting the government cost. So it means, from the concern that was raised by David, and I think he was quite a little bit hungry yesterday in relation to lunch that was organized by the department, and he wanted his names to always feature in those lunches. So maybe part of the cutting is related to lunch, that is those lunches very good or what? Or are they ones that are helping, or are they increasing the budget of government? It's there. So it does mean that, David, for you to get invitations to go to some of the government activities might be, have to be cut, so that you don't, the committee, the portfolio committee, don't go to those activities. It means it will be part of our own contribution. It is there, that's what the Minister of Finance is putting forward as part of the proposal, that yes, each department and every one of us would have to help in that particular environment. So we'd have to monitor your lunches and your traveling expenses around the world, so that we do know that it don't increase the budget of the portfolio. So that it does help us from the defense and military veterans as a contribution that we should be able to make, that we have to monitor and see to it that those things are not like bringing or increasing the budget itself or the expenditure itself. So part of the issues that we would always be concerned about are going to also relate to that how many lunches do you take a day, and see if you can cut down on the expense of the state. But you can go down. I know to me you don't need a lot. You can answer, Sector.
The Chair, on the matter of the Stula, the actual report having been submitted, we'll check that, but it is on record as having been discussed. by the previous committee. And that's one of the things that yes, it was, but it doesn't seem in the report itself what I could propose was not submitted. Yes. Yes, as I said at the beginning, it is a matter that we need to be clear that with the minister before submitting them to the committee, taking into account the discussions as well that took place and whatever resolutions the committee made, because the committee did make certain observations with respect to that. So we'll need to look at, against that background, is there still a need to submit that particular report. On the matter of the interest and the whether this was submitted, there is, as we did explain previously, statutorily there is a requirement for the submission of financial disclosures by all members of the senior management service across government, not only in the Department of Defense. And those entries have to be in at the end of each financial year and submitted to the accounting officer, after which then to the minister, and then to the Public Service Commission, which gives an overall record of how many departments have submitted and so on, and what the status of that is. They actually even released their report, I think, for 2007-08, an overall report with respect to this. So this has been duly submitted, that financial disclosure as required. And then the matter of the security clearance.
Can you just clarify that? It has been submitted to you.
Yes.
Okay.
I'm reiterating what we said earlier.
Yeah.
Well, earlier, as in the previous meeting.
So, Parliament, we can access it through you.
Can you repeat?
I'm just asking that, can Parliament have access to that documentation, declaration of its interest? Or how does it work?
Well, we have ordinarily not have had to submit it to Parliament. So that's why I was mapping out the process that every member of the senior management service, including the accounting officer, has to make those returns by the end of the financial year, at least not later than a month even, after the end of the financial year for the previous reporting period. After which all of those are then submitted to the executive authority. And the executive authority then takes them further to submit them to the Public Service Commission, which then is a repository for government with respect to that. We have not, at least as far as I know or remember, we have not had to submit those to Parliament. The comments, Chair, and the observations you've made about the improvements in the procurement systems, we certainly agree. Where there is a need for improvement after certain observations, we will look at that and then make the necessary amendments to whatever policies within the department are guiding that process. Also taking into account whatever Treasury guidelines are within this regard, insofar as the procurement systems are involved. On cutting costs, we are committed to that. In fact, we had placed a moratorium, the minister placed a moratorium on foreign travel about 2 months ago. So up to at least the end of October. But to then rigorously review each foreign travel engagement in terms of absolute necessity, because Chair, it should be noted that in a lot of instances or in certain cases, there are certain contractual obligations or certain agreements that are in place which have to be serviced by the department. So that then necessitates that there is an undertaking foreign travel, or as part of support to government for example, if the president may be traveling to a particular place and there is a need for an input from the defense side. So, but we are cognizant of that, including the matter of the size of delegations, ensuring that it's kept to the absolutely essential within that, including, of course, travel also domestically, not just foreign, but also domestic. Actually, the biggest expenditure is on domestic, not foreign.
You have a question? Can I start with you?
Thank you, Chairperson. There was a question that was posed by Dr. Dodo yesterday on the remuneration of the office bearers of SAMBA, which was not answered by the effective. The interest that you know who is being paid and how. Thank you.
Got a question?
I have a number of follow-up questions arising from my previous questions, and then I'll introduce a new question. On the question of Project Vistula, there was a commitment to provide a report. That report has not been provided. Secretary of Defense ended his response by saying, by questioning whether there is in fact a need for the department to submit that report. Now, provided this committee agrees, there was a commitment to get that report. I would like a date on which the committee will receive that report, because, Chair, this has been going. The Secretary of Defense has undertaken to get certain documents to this committee. He has not done so, and it seems to me that we could get into a situation, which is a situation I'm sure that I would like to avoid and that everybody on our committee would avoid, but we would be left with no choice then to begin proceedings, presumably, to subpoena those reports. But I would, on Project Vistula, I would like a date on which the Secretary of Defense is going to provide the report to the committee. It's simple. That's the third question. The second question is on vetting. The Secretary of Defense is unsure about whether Mr. Zondi has in fact been vetted. Do you know whether in fact a process to vet Mr. Zondi has even begun? I think that's a pertinent question. The vetting may not be complete and may not have an active status, but has a process to begin vetting begun? I was unclear about your answer in respect of interests. Am I correct that you confirmed that, in fact, Mr. Zondi has provided the relevant documents to the relevant authority? If that is correct, then again, I mean, you made a commitment to this committee that that document would be supplied to this committee. The question is, where is it? And I would like you again to commit to a date on which this committee would receive the document. Chair, those are the follow-up questions. Again, under the Defence Supply Chain Governance, in preparing for this committee meeting, I took a look at various companies that provide services to the Department of Defence. And in reading through the report, what I would do is to check whether each company in question, in fact, is a registered company. And I found, to my surprise, that two companies. One is a company called Crossroads Consulting House, and that's on page 75 of the annual report. It is not, at least according to the CIPRA database, a registered company. That information may be outdated or wrong. There's also a company on page one of the management report called Classic One Consortium, which was also not a insofar as I could see, a registered company. My question to the secretary is he familiar with these companies, or could he perhaps shed some light on what contracts these companies may have and why they may or may not in fact be registered companies?
Any other question? But also, Sir, if you take us to the two, how does it come to two, that it became 2 billion, this type of expenditure, and made a crisis with the audit committee. Since that's why I wanted the audit team to be here, but to get from them that how do they manage this process, because part of your qualification is about consulting companies. What is exactly happening? Share some light to us that why would we arrive at such a skyrocketing figure when the expenditure on consulting? That's quite high, the normal, so that the auditor general would give you a qualification around that particular area. What is exactly going on there? Would you take us into that type of thinking? And more and more, do you think some of the officials or the participants within the consulting company have they got anything to do with the department itself as a family member or whatsoever? Just give us some sense of what is the environment around that particular area so that you could be able to deal with it. If we do have to help you, alert us if you think you are on top of it, you'll be able to reduce it for the coming. End of the budget, take us away so that we could be able to have to pull down this type of challenge that we have around the audit report about these 2 billion expenditure. Over to you, September. If there's any other person who's got knowledge about those consulting companies, rather than let them help us to understand the environment under which you're working around.
Okay, to start off with the question that was asked by the honorable member with respect to remuneration of office bearers of the South African Assembly Superintendents Association, the answer is those members are not remunerated at this time. The members of the South African Assembly Superintendents Association are not remunerated. However, when they engage in activities with the department, there is a specific, I wouldn't really call it remuneration, but there is a specific allowances that they would receive for whatever travel and subsistence that they would have incurred in the engagement of those activities. For example, at the moment, as we're setting up the military veterans entity department, they are involved in that process as well. So they would be covered from a subsistence and travel point of view in terms of whatever activities that they engage in towards fulfilling that goal.
Can I just have a follow-up question, please, on that?
Yes.
I've read the medium-term budget. It seems you are getting money for the military veterans. That means that they will still want time. What does that mean? I know that you said we must wait for a proper analysis from the deputy minister. But we have a sense, and part of your submission to the National Treasury, that they want the administrative staff, or how is it going to operate there, to give them some capacities of military veterans. If you can't answer it, that's still fine. But if you have a sense how you that would be handled, you give us more information.
Chair, we did put in earlier on, early in the financial year, we did put in as part of the budget policy proposal, top of those was the issue of the establishment of the military veterans department. And we put in for that, and that was one of about six of the policy proposals that we put in. The National Treasury did commit that is the only one that they would then fund for the current financial year. also into the medium-term expenditure framework period. So at the moment, we are in the process of looking at costing of the establishment of the structure, as well as, of course, the personnel associated with that. And you will see when the presentation then comes later, what are the budgetary projections with respect to that. We are doing that in the context of the national macro organization of the state project, which is basically looking at all of the departments that have had new mandates added to them, all departments or all ministries that have had new mandates, or even totally new departments. So part of what the Minister of Finance indicated as an allocation for new departments and ministries, our little bit is also considered within that. The other question, when will the report be provided on the Stula? Chair, lest I be subpoenaed, that report will be provided once it has been cleared by the minister. It has to be cleared by the minister, before submission to Parliament.
No, we'll sort it out. I mean, I think you're correct. It has to go to the minister before it comes to Parliament. But it has more of the time frame. Do you know when we'll be able to submit it? We will check with them from our own side. But can we get that type of report?
Chair, I will not commit a specific time frame, a date and a time. Suffice to say that there is a need for the committee to look at what its predecessor did with respect to that. So if that could also be availed to the honourable members, and then we'll proceed from there.
No, I'm saying within the parliamentary time.
Yes.
From the information we have, that has not been made available.
Yes.
But we'll check that. What we are looking for is your own commitment on your side, as we sort it out from our side. I know that all the legacy report, in the legacy report, I've shared it with quite a lot of members, whatever their concerns have been, or things that they've come across. We have been able to give that type of information. But what mainly is that the report that is more solid about what has been going on, and what David is saying, the Honorable David, is that there was a report that was supposed to have been given after the investigation has been done. And you are saying that can only be the one that can be submitted first to the minister, and from the minister then it comes to Parliament. That's the part where I'm looking for. Yeah. We will engage with you with the details, David, that when that it is available. But we'll also clear the area of concern that is there a report that is substantial, that is in front of the committee that has ever been submitted. Not a report that they're looking for solely. That's what is that the members were asking from the past. That could be given to members as well. We will attend to that one. They'll go forward.
Chair, on the vetting, whether it was done or started, yes, it has started. It is. That, as a normal process, before being contracted or starting service, there is a preliminary clearance that is done. That's a preliminary one that is done. Before then, the comprehensive one, depending on the level of security clearance that is required. Hence, I was saying earlier that there is a time period which then gets taken to do that. We also do that in collaboration with the National Intelligence Agency. So it's not just a defense on its own.
The consulting company.
The financial disclosure, the document As with the previous answer we have given, we will then check with respect to the submission of that to Parliament. But it has been submitted to all of those entities, up to the Public Service Commission. On the consultants, Chair, you will see that there's a whole list of the specific consultants. As reflected from page 175 of the annual report with respect to utilization of consultants, and that goes right across until page 178. Until page 177. I should preface it by saying that the utilization of a whole host of consultants within the DOD, and that would mostly be in areas where there is no inherent internal capacity to be able to deal with specific matters. Some of it may also be to do with the fact that before you undertake any activity where there's going to be huge expenditure, that there has to be an engagement of an external entity, invariably a consultant or consulting company. For instance, you will see this in a number of areas, PPP, that is public-private partnerships, transaction advisors, and so on, where we, for instance, may have a plan to construct a building or have a total overhaul of that. Now, there is a treasury regulation that then stipulates that you have to enter into a public-private partnership. That process requires that there must also be what is called a transaction advisor, who is then that transaction advisor, once so appointed, the particular fees that are paid to those. We can explain that in quite a bit of detail. With respect to that. So there's, as I say, there's a whole host of different entities. We've also had consultants to assist us with the cleaning up of our audit qualifications. In the year that they've been in, we have been able to make some progress with respect to that. It is a matter that you pick up when we deal with the audit qualifications, and there is a definite plan and an engagement of this particular consultant. Now, with respect to the specific companies, Crossroads Consulting and FED Consulting, as to whether they are registered, that was the question, registered with CIPRO, I would not know that. But ordinarily, that would be a process that is checked before there's an actual final engagement with the entity, whatever consulting company, to ensure that they have a VET certificate and all the associated regulations with respect to that. We can go and check the details.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Now, this Classic One consortium, C1C, along with the Minister of Defence and the regrettably absent Mr. Sondi, are currently being taken to court by another company for not going to tender on a 142 million rand project. Now, two of the directors or members of C1C, we're not sure what they are because there appears to be no registration, are a Mr. T. Wood and a Mr. L. Shaw. Now, this is interesting, because both of those gentlemen are former directors of Origin Exchange, the company with which Mr. Sondi has been shown to have connections. Now, to fill in my honourable colleagues, Origin Exchange was awarded a 108 million rand contract to clear unexploded ammunition from two military training grounds so the land could be returned in terms of land claims. The contract was awarded despite Origin Exchange having no track record, no money, and bidding 33 million rand more than the next highest bidder. One of Mr. Zondi's private companies shares a business address with Origin Exchange. So my question to the SANDF is, are you aware of this, Mr. Wood and Mr. Shaw, and the links between these two companies? And how do you think their names happen to come up in both deals? Is it coincidence?
Well, Chair, I am not aware of those the connections that the Honourable Member has made after the investigation. I am not aware of that, Mr. Wood and Mr. Shaw, and their linkage to the original exchange.
But you stop with being aware. How does it work? Does the procurement committee do these things without your knowledge? Because that story has been around for some time now. Is there no information that comes to the sector when there are allegations about this nature and the involvement of some of the officials in the department? Because Mr. Zondi's name, that's why the procurement committee and so on, the portfolio committee engaged him last time because it seems as if his name was coming up quite a lot. I just wanted to know that, do you share the information within the department about some of the allegations or some of the work that is being done? How does that, but you remember yesterday I said that I know that you have given some of the responsibilities to the Chief of Defense. How does it work within the department, I mean, when you, as an accounting officer, would you know some of these things? Just let's just take us through, give us a sense of, is there a problem of communication or what? I know yesterday it seems as if we are intruding or we are trying to get more to know how the department functions. I must say that it's a question that can't go away because we have interest to be able to satisfy ourselves that there is communication within the department and how that communication is working. So that if another official allegations are being made against him or her, what does the Secretary of Defense say in relation to this particular matter?
Chair, let me state for the record, I do not sit in any procurement committee or board in the department. I therefore have what I would call an arm's length relationship with those. As a result of that, I would not know to the detail that company X or Mr. So or Ms. So and so is one who is involved in this entity or that entity. So perhaps there would be a need for me to review that. But as I say, I do not, as you may recall from the presentation that was made on the whole procurement system, in terms of the different levels of that adjudication systems, the delegations from the headquarters to the procurement centers in the regions and so on. So within that context, I do not. There are officers and officials who do sit on that, but it is a matter that we need to then look at or review in terms of how then do I then get to know that absolute last detail of the entirety of involvement of procurement.
So what would be the standing of? How long would you want us to give you to be able to come back with your report in relation to this matter? That is all the details around the board in the different companies.
With respect to the questions that the Honourable Member Lorimer has asked, I would go and check that and can come back to the committee.
Is there any other member wants to? Left you, Mr.
Mr. Chair. Now, regarding the process of procurement, and particularly as relating to this origin exchange contract, I'd like to know whether you can get to us the names of the officers and officials who awarded this particular contract. I'd also like to see the documents which informed their decision. I'd like to know who drew up those documents, and I'd like to know whether Mr. Zondi instructed the tender process to accept the origin exchange bid. Would it be possible to get all those to us?
Let's clarify instruction. What has it been?
There's been an allegation.
So what you know, and I'm not saying that he said that they reduced themselves when that issue was there in relation to things where they get directly affected. What is your sense of what has been happening? So that when you say instructed, it might be a verbatim. Are you asking a verbatim instruction or is it just written down things that they're looking for? What is it that you're asking them to do?
Mr. Chairman, I'm responding to something that's been in the media, which is an allegation that Mr. Zondi instructed the tender board to award this contract to Origin Exchange. And I'd like to ask a straight question. Did he?
Do you have an answer now in relation to that matter until you engage with the board? Am I correct?
Yes, I would not know whether he actually did. As I said, I do not sit in those, and the process of verifying that he actually did or did not would warrant an investigation of possibly all the people who were in that particular meeting or committee, as well as any other relevant facts.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, I just wanted clarity from the acting secretary. From my understanding, he is the head of the accounting officer. But now, when the department, as a department, there are entities and sub-directors, all of them, to my understanding, are reporting to him. Whatever is happening in the department, he is the one person, whether there is a whistleblower or whoever, he must be aware of that. Now, what I'm picking up now from the acting secretary is that time to time when the question is posed to him, will come back and whatsoever. He's not aware of all those sort of things. Yes, I did hear him say that not in all board meetings is part of him. But where does the report? He must get the report. But even at the arms call, there must be a link, there must be a communication between the head and all these entities. Now, I'm just now confused, or I don't understand what is happening, because I take him as an accounting officer. Thank you, Chairperson.
Yeah.
Just a brief. The matter in respect of the question that my colleague, James Lyman is probing, Origin Exchange. This matter broke in the media 6 weeks ago, and yet the acting secretary of defense doesn't have the fact that he exposed them. I would presume, secretary, that on the very day that story broke in the media, you would have begun an investigation into those allegations. I mean, my question to you is, supply chain management department a concern to you, and did you in fact begin or have you begun an investigation into this matter? You must be familiar with at least the basic facts. Mr. Chair, I've got more questions to ask specifically about the contract. I don't know whether we should wait for the answers now or whether I should. Okay, well, this contract is problematic for a number of reasons. One is that Origin Exchange, the company which was awarded this contract, does not have any kind of record in demining activities. If you go to the Geneva International Center for Humanitarian Demining, you find out that there are 6 companies internationally which are famous, well known, for demining activities for the UN and other bodies all over the world. the Halo Trust, an NGO, Armour Group, BAC Technologies, MAG, MyTech International, and MECHEM. MECHEM is a subsidiary of TENEL. It's owned by our government. MyTech International was started in Southern Africa. Neither group, despite their local connections, was asked to tender. MyTech found out about it through a chance conversation and joined together in a joint bid with MECHEM. So my question is, was MECHEM not asked, why was MECHEM not asked to bid? And a more general question, is there not some kind of relationship established between MECHEM and the SANDF where MECHEM gets first bite at government work?
But I do think you would have to speak to the concern expressed by Mamu Berger there in relation to how you operate in the department and how do your authority get exercised. It also, how does a consultant have such enormous power when there are people in the department? You would have to clarify. You need to make us feel comfortable that he is Mr. Zondi, a consultant, enormous power of making decisions. And there are people who are active in the department itself who don't have that type of power. And his name now is beginning to imagine the type of contracts or type of deals that have been given to other people. How does that happen? And the secretary, the acting secretary, doesn't know what is going on there, even if you are at a distance from that particular matter. Mamu Berger is correct to say that. He then talks a lot of the work of the acting secretary, that how does it in his real relationship and even what happens in arms court. We know that, I mean, that we also have to look around for the type of answers that would help us as a portfolio committee to go around. And I did emphasize this something that we are pushing based on being informed that we are the accounting officer. Whatever arrangements have done is that it doesn't change that original position legally. And that the secretary has given us that you are the accounting officer. And we need to re-emphasize that. So questions are directed to you, sir, just to be able to give us answers. If I already said that if you can't do that, give us another direction, go to us. But there's no other person where we are going to get this type of answer. That we talk to you. But Mr. Lerma, we also have to not go into that, we would have to go also into other issues, not that particular one, if you agree.
Mr. Chair, I'm happy with that, but I'd like to then draw your attention. I mean, there's a lot more questions about this contract. When this came up in Parliament on the 14th, I believe, I asked the minister whether she would be investigating procurement processes and driving changes to legislation or rules that will forbid officials, specifically those involved in procurement, from having any business interests outside of their jobs. And the minister said, and I quote here, should the Portfolio Committee on Defence and Military Veterans require me to investigate the matter, I'm open to that. Now, rather than just the look at improving procurement processes, as has been suggested, can I suggest that the committee formally ask the minister to investigate procurement over a set time period, but certainly involving these two organizations, which are these two contracts which have been named this morning?
The last part I'll put into committee overall when we finish with our engagement. I don't want that one to stop. Any other things that we want to clear your mind about. And I just want to give the September opportunity to keep on answering. But I think you're all in Parliament when that commitment was made. And if committee members agree that the route, after you have asked questions that they're not satisfied, we then have to take up that route and then take the minister on that way.
Mr. Chairman, do I understand you correctly that I should leave off questions, or can I just go ahead and go right through them?
You want to go into the detail of the
there's a lot more worrying stuff, Mr. Chairman.
No, that's fine. I have been giving you an opportunity to raise it. but I don't want also the committee to just debate one issue for the whole day. We should spread ourselves to see if there are other concerns in the annual report that we want to engage into. But if there's nothing else that can stop you from asking questions, we've got enough time to engage into it. But also don't want to do the investigation. The fact that we've already admitted up front that he doesn't have the details of what he's admitted to. So it would be like hitting on the same spot when someone would continuously say that he didn't have the details of what is going on. I'll size up the questions without what they are going to ask, and we'll then see if you can put them compile a report and produce and give it to him and give it to the minister and ask us to make a detailed follow-up for what we have to do for the committee.
Mr. Chairman, what I'll do then is I'll leave aside some of the other questions and perhaps redirect a question to General Nkonyane, who, when we discussed the matter before in committee, he spoke about this Origin Exchange tender being decided on Origin's ability to do deep clearance of explosives. These are unexploded munitions going into the ground. Now, deep clearance was not specified in the tender documents as being a requirement. What was specified were international mine action standards, in other words, clearance to 50 centimeters deep. Interestingly enough, the Mechem Minetech companies did specify that they would go down to 50 centimeters as required by the international standards. And interestingly, both companies have a reputation for being able to do deep level clearance. I know that the Minetech part of the consortium, or the bid, have cleared up to 7 meters deep in countries like Laos, where they cleared the Ho Chi Minh Trail. So I'm interested in knowing, if this was the case, how was deep level clearance and the ability to do it, how was that the deciding factor in this award?
I just want to check. You see, yesterday we agreed that most questions would go until the Secretary of Defense directs. But then Nkonyane would form part of his delegation to the Northern Eastern one is old. So I just have to check with him. He's the Secretary of Defense. He's had around 161 people. So Nkonyane an opportunity or what do you want to do?
Now, Chair, let me start, may I, with the question that Honourable Member Mapeza has asked. I do receive reports with respect to the activities of the division that fall under me with the department. With respect to this particular matter, just to reiterate what I had said when we were at another meeting, when this matter was discussed, yes, there were reports that were given to me to seek an explanation about this matter. And I also said, and I reiterate that, I have launched an investigation in the department with respect to this matter. That investigation to be conducted by the Inspector General. And it is still underway. And I also said that we will, once that is completed, come back to the committee. We'll take into account the questions, comments, remarks that were asked at that time, as well as any other matter that may be deemed relevant to this particular matter. So that is underway.
So you are saying that Mr. Nkonyane won't answer now. We'll close that matter and ask us to be
there. Yes, we'll take the records or the questions as asked will be taken on board as part of the entirety of the investigation.
Can you move on or do you want to say something? It must not be any conversation that's between the two of you. But what will you go? But the resolution and the committee will take it up in a manner that has been suggested. That one will come
to. Well, really, two questions, Mr. Chair. The one is there any possibility that the Inspector General will expand his investigation to cover this C1C report as well. And secondly, when we were informed about the Inspector General's report, the sector was unable to give us a time frame for when this report might be concluded, but said he would be able to provide one. Is he able to provide one now? Tell us when we will get this Inspector General's report.
Again, making a commitment that you do a full investigation and come back to the committee. But you see, I know why there's an urgency of on the side of the member. You know that you have to submit this report to the executive. And the question would have arisen from the members of parliament. So that's why we have to take both the commendations that you are working on the case. And we have to submit the case for the minister. She has made a parliamentary commitment that we have to give the full report to her and ask her to investigate the particular matter. She has assured that she could be able to take it up. So it could get closer to us, the concerns of members are raising around this particular case. Is that okay? Do you understand, Septem?
I'm trying to understand the last part.
The last part says, you can proceed with what they're doing. The members are asking us to, the minister has committed herself in parliament to say, if there's cases and allegations, can you submit a report to me so that I can be able to do investigation and refer it to the necessary institutions to do with this particular matter. I'm saying that that is also going to go ahead on top of what you are doing. Yeah, so then, the Lord might ask this question inside Parliament, and the Minister did that commitment inside Parliament. And now he has put this question in front of you to get more information about what is happening. He still feels that the committee must follow the route that has been suggested by the Ministry of engaging her. I mean, I'm just reiterating the positions that have been set, and trying to assist my secretary that from here, where do we go around this particular matter? That's what I have to say. That is put you, okay.
Well, I have no authority to say yay or nay to what Parliament wishes to decide, but to state again that the departmental investigation is underway. And out of that, then whenever further steps that have to be taken, further steps will then be taken, arising from that particular, the report of that investigation.
And whatever the Inspector General comes up with, it will all be part of the report that will ever submit to Parliament. Is this investigation handled by the Inspector General?
Yes.
Can you proceed? So you are going to hold me accountable in how we write and cut out the letter that goes to the minister to handle and train up this particular matter. So it's quite clear, Inspector, that this matter won't go off the radar because we'll have to answer and satisfy Parliament. And there is a ministerial commitment to the parliamentary process when the questions are asked. Can we go to another place? Mambo Bed, are you okay with your answer? Okay, that's fine. Can we go ahead?
Thank you, Chair. I'd like to then shift the focus to the sub-program on human resource support services. Now, in the Auditor General's report, under consultant expenditure, there was 193 million rands worth of expenditure paid to a consultant that could not be verified. Now, at our last hearing, the Auditor General informed this committee that that expenditure was in respect of a company called the Aero Manpower Group. Now, it transpires that the Aero Manpower Group is a company which the Department of Defense pays roughly 19 million rand per month to in return for the services of approximately 600 individuals. And these individuals, if I understand correctly, provide technical services to the South African Air Force. Now, my question through the Secretary to the human resource specialists is, Aero Manpower Group is a labor broker. What are the consequences of banning labor brokering for the relationship between the Department of Defense and the Aero Manpower Group? More particularly, what are the consequences for the South African Air Force? And my question to the Secretary, is this a concern? Because it would seem to me that if legislation was passed in Parliament that in fact banned labor brokering, there's a risk. And the risk is that the 600 technicians who support the South African Air Force would be put out of business. And I would conclude that the risk here is that in fact the South African Air Force could be put out of business. Would you be prepared to comment?
So the matter of the AMG contract is a concern which we are addressing. We are looking at it with respect to the concerns that the Auditor General has raised. I should say even before the Auditor General picked it up, it was a matter that we were looking at with respect to a whole range of areas around it. When was it concluded? With who? What is the expenditure, is it necessary, and then all of that. So that when the AG then picked it up, we did agree that it is a matter that we need to sort out and also ensure that we clear it from being an emphasis of matter or an audit qualification. So we are addressing it, this matter of the AG contract.
Go a little bit forward to say what are we doing if ever there's a debate about the labor broker? What implications it have for the department itself if the legislation come across? Let's say the labor broker would be there. What are we going to do?
Well, we would need to look at that in terms of what are the implications or what else do we put in place. I didn't know that there were labor brokers, but I knew it as a matter that is of serious concern, as also confirmed by the Auditor General. Hence, we're undertaking that investigation to look at that expenditure and the regularity of that expenditure. And to what is that expenditure going?
It seems that the Secretary of Defense was taking over my lessons from Mr. Engelbrecht in artfully dodging answers to questions. My point, does the Secretary of Defense accept that AMG is a labor broker? I mean, it's a company which receives a payment of roughly 19 million rand per month in return for providing 600 technicians to the South African Air Force. I mean, if he disagrees with me that it's a labor broker, that AMG is a labor broker, he should say so. But it seems to me just simple common sense that AMG is a labor broker. And if labor brokering were banned, there is a serious risk to the South African Air Force.
You see the other thing that is astounding me, that you said that when before the Auditor General came into this matter, you were already sorting it out. Now you are saying after that you didn't know that they are labor brokers.
So I'm trying to work out exactly what were you sorting out. Were you sorting out the company, the expenditure that, and it was what did come out that this is an expensive exercise and done by labor brokers. And today everybody knows that everybody is talking about labor brokers and trying to get rid of them. Now I don't know if there is a plan to be able to what everybody is trying to do, honorable members trying to raise me. What is the future plan if ever this labor brokers have to be withdrawn from the department? But we are saying now that we didn't know that they are labor brokers. So it does bring a little bit of concern, coming back to the original question of Mamu Bell, of saying that what is it that we then understand that happens in the department? So we could understand. But if we don't even know that they are labor brokers, what will they be investigating about them? To sort out the manner of how much they have been paid, which has created, if we have another question. What is it that they are sorting out now? Give us a sense of what they are sorting out.
Yes, sir. As I said, what contract do they have? What is the nature and scope of that contract? What is the expenditure? Is it a contract that is worth keeping? What would be the implications and all of that? Those are some of the things that we're looking at. And also to ensure that whatever it is, that the Air Force is utilizing for is actually what the Air Force requires. So we were looking at it from a whole range of different points of view. We are addressing it even within our own. We have a structure called the AMC, the Accountability Management Committee, which meets every month to look at all the matters related to accountability, flow of expenditure, audit reports and the extent to which we are clearing those and which entities have received those quantified points. But I would venture to say that the committee should cross-reference that when you address the program on the Air Force, Program 7 on the Air Force, because it is primarily in the Air Force domain.
Move on to another question.
Chair, if you like, I could describe what it is the Secretary of Defense is in fact dealing with. It seems that the Aero Manpower Group is a very serious problem. I'm satisfied that the Secretary acknowledges that the Secretary has put in place mechanisms to deal with that. So I would, in fact, probably want to just move on to a different question. Okay. But it is an extremely serious situation. Let me move then, again, on under the Human Resource Support Services Program. I'd like to move to the question of grievances and disputes. Now, the department in its report says that there is a credible mechanism to resolve grievances at the lowest possible level. That's a performance target, I think, on page 49 of the report, and it's ticked off remarkably as achieved. I think it's page 1, I stand under correction, page 149. Under the table complaints mechanism, a single grievance procedure for members and employees of the DAP, a credible mechanism to resolve grievances at the lowest possible level in the shortest possible time. And this, my question is about the grievance system. If you look at information in respect of grievances, there's reference to 16, I think it is, grievances, which the Department of Defense are dealing with. Now, my question to the Secretary of Defense, my hypothesis is that the grievance system in the South African National Defense Force does not work. But it doesn't seem to me that the Secretariat measures the total number of grievances in the Department of Defense, and whether those are resolved or unresolved. I mean, it seems to me impossible that there could only be, and I stand under correction, 16 odd grievances in the Department of Defense. So does the Department of Defense have a system in place to monitor the total number of grievances? How many of those grievances are resolved? How many of those grievances are unresolved? And if indeed we do have that mechanism, what are the relevant figures?
How does the prison system work? But we also have thousands of people who said for quite some time that it's done incredibly to your office to be able to be sorted out. No response seems to be coming from you. I gave you the last time a 6-5 of outstanding incredibly and sent you. These are the concerns of what people are expressing. What did you say about it?
Chair, there is a grievance system in place, also a dispute resolution system that is in place. As the report does indicate, that has been devolved right to the lowest level, that is a unit, within the entirety of the Department of Defense. We also submit on a monthly and quarterly basis our returns with respect to the extent to which we are dealing with grievances to the Public Service Commission, because some of them would have come from the Public Service Commission. So we deal with that collaboratively with the Public Service Commission, giving returns of the extent of the grievances that we have received, those that we have investigated, those that we have concluded, and those that are still in process. I don't have the exact figures as of now, but the process is in place and it does exist. And I'll ask Dr. Thomas just briefly talk to that particular system. Also noting that there are two tracks. The one is with respect to civilians in the DOD, and then the other with respect to the military.
Thank you, Chairperson, honorable members. The grievance procedure that is indicated in the annual report as achieved, it is the envisaged grievance procedure that has been developed, and in conjunction with that grievance procedure, we have developed a software program that will enable anybody at any place to be able to monitor if a grievance has been lost according to the correct process and to find out whether this grievance has been finalized within the stipulated time frame. Currently, for the military, that grievance procedure is being converted into regulations, and it is in the process of being promulgated. And with regard to civilians, there is a grievance procedure that is publicized by the Public Service Commission that is utilized, and people have to follow the correct procedure in order for the grievances and disputes to be visible to everybody. Because even if you can take a grievance to a higher level like the GPSSBC, as long as you did not follow the correct procedure, it will not be entertained. They want everybody to follow the correct procedure that is laid down in terms of the law. But we do have the grievance procedure, and it is supported by a software system, and we are currently training all unit commanders and managers to be able to utilize the system. Thank you.
I can have some more interest in what you're saying. See,
some of us are struggling to understand why did you not yet have a grip within the SND. Because when unions, I mean, out of experience gets formed, it gets formed because problems are not being solved within the, I mean, the SNDF itself. And their major complaint is that their grievances are not being attended to. That's why there is not to unions. So in the platforms and spaces where we sometimes bump into such, they are very disconcerted that they write letters to the department, there's no response. That's why they resort to get together and become a collective. Get unionized. So if you put that as an achievement, then why would there be unionization taking place within the SNDF in such a big way? Because there's quite a lot of unionization taking place. And part of the process is that they are not satisfied of how management is handling their problems in the SNDF. So to say your system is really working on what are the real criticisms that we are facing, and how long is this system to be in place? If you could just give us a sense, so that we know what we are talking about. Let me just check if members have got
okay. Same issue, Chair, the follow-up. Given the statement that the reference on, is it page 149, is to the envisaged grievance system, can I take it as that the existing grievance system does not work? Do you agree or not agree with that statement? The second is, I asked a question about figures. How many grievances are unresolved currently in the Department of Defense, broken down by civilian and military? Even if you do not have the exact figure today, what is the rough figure? Thank you.
Chairperson, now with regard to the question you asked, why people run to unions if there is a credible grievance system. When somebody has a grievance, even if you can respond to the person, if the person is dissatisfied with the answer that you are providing, the person will run to the union with the hope that the union will provide a better answer than you as an employer have provided. And secondly, many people do not follow the correct procedure. Hence I said, if you do not follow the correct procedure, we will not be able to know exactly how many grievances have been placed on record. So a lot of people place grievances, some go to the commander-in-chief, some to the public protector, some everywhere. So as a result, you find if they are not satisfied with whatever responses they receive, then they will go and join the union with the hope that they will receive some satisfaction. And then with regard to the grievance procedure that is working, the current one that is in place, particularly with regard to the uniform grievance procedure, it is currently not working. The reason being that we are unable to monitor if a commander is not finalizing a grievance that has been lodged by a member on time. It is difficult for someone sitting at headquarters to can be able to find out that this commander has not been able to comply with the rules. So the one that we have put in place, that we are in the process of promulgating in regulation, it has not yet started working for the military because we still have to promulgate the regulations. That one, we have a software support system that immediately somebody lodges a grievance, it can be registered in the system, and anybody who wishes to monitor how many grievances have been lodged for today will be able to see the number that has been lodged. Those that are falling behind, that are not being resolved on time, you can also have that information too. But it will still start to work once it has been promulgated. And the process of promulgation has to follow the process of the rules. And then as to the number, I cannot at this point provide the exact number. At another date, I can be able to supply those numbers to the committee. Thank you.
Now, I also have a follow-up. You see, I have a follow-up because now we have put a commission in place, the intermilitary commission, to be able to assist in investigating how to keep the soldiers healthy. And, you know, I'm grappling with what you're saying, that how will it assist? Could we, for the members of parliament at the end of the day, that report has to come to us. And if you could reflect to us in a more stronger way, that if that can that help to become part of the solution of how we handle the issues that are related to the grievance procedure within the SNDF, even if you say that you should assist or ask the centers to assist you to fast track the issue of regulation, is it what you think could help to resolve some of the tensions and issues that have pushed people out of the command and into getting unionized? So you would know for a matter of fact that our major other concern, not that we want to be unionized, but the point is what implications would and what would strengthen the commission to be able to make sure part of its own decision and or suggestions of how we resolve issues within the SNDF, what you are saying would be able to help us to recommend to that commission that there is a mechanism that could be effective in resolving some of the tensions and the concerns that are being raised by the soldiers. Now, that way, in that context, that I'm more interested to do that, is this system really working? And if you say you clock it in now, I mean, I've got piles and piles of people who are complaining who are coming here. I mean, they don't want to be involved in the union, but they've got serious problems and serious concerns in how you are handling issues within the department. So give us really something solid that can the committee learn something out of that process and make a recommendation to the commission to work that these are part of the things that we could use to resolve some of the problems within the SNDF. Just give us that guarantee that some of yours will be able to help. If it can't, then the system that I'm saying that would sound as if we created it and by the time the commission is reporting back, we then have to say that that system is not working, we then have to kick it out. And how much will it cost us? How much of the cost us goes along with this type of system that you're talking about? Can you just
I mean, I want to thank the official for being frank. I mean, my understanding of what the official has said is that the grievance system is not working. That's the first thing, in respect of the uniformed members. The second thing is that the member said that she is not sure what the total number of unresolved grievances are and cannot provide an exact number. I did not ask for an exact number. I accept that you cannot tell me today on exactly how many grievances there are for two reasons. The first is, I mean, you don't know, and the system doesn't provide you for a real-time, if you like, window on exactly how many grievances there are each day. I accept that. But I would still like to know what the approximate number of unresolved grievances are in the Department of Defense. You must have the numbers available because in your performance management, your report in the annual report, you say that only that your target is to resolve 80% of grievances, but you only succeeded in the financial year on resolving 60% of those grievances. So it must be quantifiable. You must be able to give us an approximate number of unresolved grievances.
Yes, thank you.
If the member so insists, then we can ask that a call be made to establish that the approximate, it will still be approximate, and not a total or exact figure.
Chair,
see the challenge at that is when you put it in the report to Parliament, and please have a sense of what figures you're talking about and how many have been involved. It can become, but when it says achieved, it means that you do understand what was the target in that year, and how in your target that you have presented in the last time of the financial year, you are confident that this number of people is happiness. And I thought that's what all the members would go. But if I go on looking to the other pages, to go to 153, and you look at vacancies and employment, you have correct, you have some figures. So I'm just saying that if the member, I'm saying that the official doesn't have the capacity of saying how many people that he talks about that has made it to feel comfortable that there is some achievement that has been done within the department itself. I will take what we are saying, but it's a question of do you want to test if the system is working. But if he doesn't know given the figures, it becomes a problem of how did you arrive at saying that we have achieved something. But there's, I mean, you are talking about counting heads. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. These are 6 people. And these people, out of the 6, 5 of them are satisfied. And that's what makes you to be happy to come and report to Parliament that there is a particular achievement. That's all we're looking for in this particular moment. And maybe the person responsible can give you a sense of what we're talking about. Can we check for the last time if it's possible? If it's not possible, we don't have to walk for what the system is.
Chair, just a brief follow-up. I do accept that the Secretary can only at this stage provide an approximate number, and I would certainly welcome him making the call so that we can get an idea of the approximate number of grievances lodged, the approximate number of grievances resolved, and the approximate number of grievances that remain unresolved. And I do accept that that is an estimated number. Thank you.
Give me permission to go outside and call my people to give me the number.
The real one is sure that some of yours is working.
Well, sir, the one that I talked about is not yet implemented, as I said. It's still to be promulgated into regulations before we can implement it. But this is in terms of the current one that is in place.
Is to give each other 5 minutes to stretch your legs and take some coffee and tea so that you could come back refreshed and the member can attend to it. Good morning. All right. Hello, Brooke. Are you a military veteran? Are you a military veteran?
Not today.
Okay. Where are we? Well, with you. Did you get the information?
Thank you, Senators and Honorable Members. We have currently the grievances that we are aware that they followed the correct procedure when they were lodged and they were visible to us. 153 grievances that are active, 118 are military, and 35 are civilian. And I will be affecting the detailed report in terms of various services. Army, SAM, Navy, how many grievances are there? It will be provided for the member.
That's what the member is. She has simply done the job. You can.
Can you just, I just want to be absolutely sure. I mean, again, I accept the Secretary's position that this is an approximate number. The number of grievances, are these unresolved grievances? Total number of grievances, or are these the total number of grievances?
When we say they are active, that means that they are still in the system. We are investigating them until they are resolved. Once the grievance is resolved, it's taken off the system.
No, I was saying we remove it. It's removed. So as Dr. Dawa explained, it's the active one that has been lodged, formally lodged, and there's an investigation underway. There may be a different thing, but there is active.
Thank you for providing that figure. I would have thought that for 153 grievances in the Department of Defense that the figure is low. Now, this is an estimated figure, and you are clearly, and I'm pleased to hear, setting up a new system. I mean, how accurate do you think that figure is? I would have thought that there would have been thousands of unresolved grievances. That's just an armchair. How accurate do you think that figure is?
There are two things I want to know about grievances. Now you see you have introduced a new thing that goes according to the division you belong to, that is Air Force, this one. How much of that has ever been communicated to members of the Defense Force, human beings? And how has that communication been happening so that they can understand that if you have a grievance, this is how you refer it. Now, I know that the department does have a legal division of its own. At which stage does a grievance become a crime? How do you sort it out? Do the old grievance start with you and then you transfer them to other divisions, or what exactly happens? Just give us the sense of how the system is working. And how does the legal department get involved? Or are you working alone around this area? Just take us through.
Firstly, the accuracy of the number I have just provided. I have indicated in my previous statement that as long as the grievance has been lodged in accordance with the process that has been laid down, we will be able to know that this is a grievance that has followed the correct process.
Can you just give us the process? Because when the process has been laid down, what does ordinary members of the SNGF understand, in the army or anywhere? How do they understand that? Give us the process.
The process, if you have a concern first, you may communicate your concern to your immediate supervisor. If your immediate supervisor doesn't do anything, if you verbally communicated it, then you can put it in writing. And then after you put it in writing and you submitted it, the immediate supervisor has 7 days to respond to your grievance. If within 7 days the supervisor is not responding to your grievance, then you can remind the supervisor to say, I have lost a grievance on such and such a day, and you have not yet responded. And as a result, I'm taking it forward. And then you can take it to the next level. And if the next level does not also respond within 7 days, then you rise again to say, I have lodged this grievance, and now I'm taking to the next level until you reach the level of Chief SANDF, or if it's in the service, the level of Chief Army and so on. If Chief Army has not responded to you, you take it to the Chief of SANDF. If Chief SANDF has not responded, you have the right to write to the Commander-in-Chief. This is the procedure that is taught to everybody, that this is the process you follow. So this 153 grievances that I said are active, these are the ones that have been lost in accordance with the rules that have put down. If there are grievances that have been lodged, maybe they directly submitted, maybe to Parliament or to the Commander-in-Chief or the Public Protector or Public Service Commission, we will not have any knowledge of those until the Public Service Commission or the Public Protector Community write to us to say, do you know of such a grievance than this member who has submitted a grievance to us? Otherwise, this 153 are the ones that we are knowledgeable of that have been laid down in terms of the rules.
Any other question? Beyond this one. Lambo. There's any other question? Find me.
Okay.
I like you going to go.
No.
Can I come in?
Thank you, Chair. I'd like to stay on human resources and move to the MSDS program. And I refer, Secretary, to page 147 of your report. There are two aspects about the program that I'm concerned about. First, I'm not exactly sure of the figures. I mean, the figures to me seem to suggest that in the previous financial year, we admitted 4,334 MSDS members. But during the same year, 1,445 MSD members left the service. But of more concern, only 102 were recruited to the reserves. So my question, first of all, is how many MSDS members are leaving or left the service in the last financial year, and what were the reasons for that? Second question, and this is of great concern, is how many members were then subsequently recruited into the reserves? Because in the documents, the primary, if you like, feed-in system for the reserves is apparently the MSDS system. But it seems that a very small number of MSDS members are, after their service, recruited into the reserves. Could you deal with it?
I don't have the figure of how many have left the service, but what you have there is the intake for the financial year. The leaving the service, we can obtain that as of now. Since the completion of the annual report, we can avail that to the committee, as well as the number who've gone into the stream of the reserve, and then lastly the number but also to mention that there is a planned intake for 2010. Further planned intake for 2010, and we can give those figures. Not at this stage.
The information that we have in page 147, that is the correct one.
Yes, but in terms of the number exiting, that is beyond that, because this is until the report is until the end of March. So I'm saying end of now, because they come in at different stages, mainly in January and then in July. But Dr. Zaba can add some of the other details.
Chief, that's, I mean, the figures seem to suggest that we might be losing up to 25% of our recruits during that two-year period. I mean, that may or may not be accurate, but it seems that if that is true, that there's a difficulty retaining members recruited through the MSDS system, which might suggest that we recruiting the wrong individuals. I mean, are individuals, for example, leaving because they don't, for example, meet the required fitness standard or for whatever reason? The figure might not be correct. But what does seem to be correct is that a very small proportion of our MSDS members seem to be subsequently recruited into the reserves. I mean, and that is of serious concern.
More than that, also the Youth Commission is entrusted in this program. So if understand what is the problem, because it could be nice to assist, so that when the Youth Commission and different youth show interest in this particular program, we really encourage them to assist, to maintain people in the system, because in general, it's a challenge about young people in the country, that how do we handle issues that are related to them. So if you could give us more information, even to show that what makes people to leave or exit out of the system, maybe we, as parliament, in a positive way, we should assist you to make sure that young people are remaining within the program, because it is helping the country overall. We want to welcome the veteran. There's only one veteran, that's Mr. Tumlaki. Good morning, Mr. Tumlaki. Your apologies are accepted. By a foot, by a foot. Yeah. By a donkey, Mr. Tumlaki.
The MSDS intake effect of October 1st, 2009 is 7,491. And 162 of those members exited within 1 month of joining, and 2,318, they finalized their contract and they moved it to the core service system, and then 1,168 exited before 2 years contract is finalized. And as a result, we have now 10,372 MSD in the system. The concern of us not having enough MSDs who goes to the reserve, it is a serious concern to us. That's why we have amended the HR strategy to ensure that we have two streams of recruitment. One stream will be to recruit for those who will be retained within the department, and the other stream will be for those who will move to the reserve. And upon recruitment, when you recruit people at entry point, you will have to specifically inform the members. You will not be able to stay for a longer period in the department. You are recruited for the reserve, and others, when you come in, you will be recruited for full-time contract. So we have amended the HR strategy in that way to start that process. Thank you.
Chair, thank you for that response. It seems a sensible solution to begin to address the problem of recruitment in reserves. I'm still a little bit concerned. If I understand the figures, that we would be losing roughly 1,400 MSDS members before they complete their two-year service. Correct me if that figure is incorrect. Why is that? Does that mean that there might be something wrong with the recruitment of those members in the first place? Why are those members leaving before their contract is completed? I think that needs an explanation and some further analysis. It's a fairly high level of drop-off.
Thank you, Chairperson. Exit interviews are conducted with these members before they exit. There are many, many reasons that causes members to exit before their two-year contract. Sometimes you find a member joining the MSD because it was the only option. So if another option comes up before the MSD contracts come to an end, then they decide to terminate the other contract and go to the next one. Like in the case of females, sometimes you find pregnancy is the one that causes them to terminate their contract. But we do advise them that once you have given birth, you can reapply back into the military, and you will be given first preference to get in if you are in good condition. But as I'm saying, there are numerous reasons that causes members to leave before that time. especially with the conditions that are going on in our country. Thank you.
I'm sorry to hop on the question. I mean, I think that, thank you for the explanation, but it would then lead to not a concern with recruitment, but a concern with the contract. I would have thought that a commitment to our Defence Force of 2 years, if you were recruited, I mean, should be a commitment for 2 years. Are you considering perhaps amending the contract to ensure that if a member is recruited under this program, that in terms of the contract, they understand they would have a commitment to 2 years service to the Defence Force?
Thank you, Chair. The contract is very clear that a person is expected to stay in the Defence Force for 2 years. But as we all know, under the Bill of Rights, you cannot be able to force an individual to stay against their will where they don't want to. So members do leave, especially if opportunities that they are going to are much greener than the opportunities within the Defence Force. Thank you. Military Skills Development Service. Thank you. For younger people between the ages of 18, we have amended our HR strategy to ensure that the recruitment age is from 18 to 24, whereas in the past it was from 18 to 22 years. So now, in order to also attract the university people, we have extended that to be 24.
I just wanted to clarify that we have made a commitment that will keep up until 11:30 on the annual report so that we could start with the custom report. So I'll give you the last round, and after this round, we then go to the custom report.
Thank you, Chair. I still wanted to cover the NCACC, which, as you know, is of not only serious concern to me, but also serious concern to the Auditor General. But I think given the time constraint, we will have to look for another opportunity to deal with the NCACC. So let me finish on with a final question. Since we are on human resources, I wonder if Secretary could shed some light on who Brigadier General P. Mari is. I believe that she is in the DH Directorate of Human Resources. And what has been done about the fact that she appears to use her telephones excessively? She appears to have notched up to 22,000 rand in unpaid telephones and cell phone bills. And her secretary is not far behind with an unpaid bill of more than 10,000 rand. Now, is there perhaps a reason for Brigadier General Mari using her cell phone and telephone in the amount of nearly 53,000 rand? Now, it seems that the Auditor General had some difficulties with explanations, Chair. The General has managed to dodge 7 meetings in order to explain why it is she's notched up this amount on her telephone call, and she seems unable to restrain her secretary. So there seems to be a problem here, and I wonder if the secretary could perhaps help us with this. You'll find reference to this on page 199 of the AG's management report.
No, we do have access to that report. So we do have the details as the AG report, but that is in the management, which makes up the report of the Auditor General. Last time we
we told the Auditor General that we're not happy about how we have crafted them. He can give us the details. So it won't be in this one, sir. It's a total different report where we get detailed details of what is exactly going on. You know this general, Brigadier General? Where is in the army or where? She might be recruiting for the army.
There might be a reasonable explanation, but I'd like to know who the general is. She might have a very important position in the Department of Defense, which might explain her excessive use of her telephone, but I mean, what's of more interest is why she wouldn't pay it back.
Yes, the officer is in the office of the Chief of Human Resources. The office of the Chief of Human Resources, Lieutenant General Mukwezi, she is the head of the Division of Staff in the office of the Chief of Human Resources. And that's a responsibility that she has. In terms of the amount owed, all amounts owed in accordance with our policy are due to be paid back by a member. So even if a name or a name plus one off of the other may appear, those monies are due to the department. There is a definite a policy that is in existence according to which all have to comply with respect to both telephone and other methods.
This one finds it so difficult to pay that and don't give me the Auditor General. She's running away from the Auditor General.
She's running, but I'm not sure who she's running from. She's running from the Secretary of Defense.
There's an entire process for collection of the revenues and all of that. But I'll ask Mr. Engelbach to just briefly explain that.
Yeah, I'll try this time not to be the onslaught dodger again. Chair, for you, I'm personally involved in this revenue collection for the department, and we are at the moment investigating. We have 96, or so rather 69 different revenue streams that we are improving on. As members are well aware, it's one of the audit qualifications. So the existing policy on telephone accounts and how it's managed is currently being revised. There's a number of recommendations that we will put forward to the Defence Staff Council in due course, where we will enhance the internal controls for the telephone, specifically in this environment for the telephone calls, then this kind of situation should be something of the past if all the recommendations that we are putting forward is accepted and implemented. We however need to take note of the fact that there needs to be an integration between the telephone management system of the department as well as the financial management system of the department to put these internal controls in place. But that is the intention. The policy should be completed by the end of December, and hopefully, depending on the time it takes to integrate the two systems, this should be completed at the latest by the end of this current financial year. So this is a grave concern for the department, and we are addressing it vigorously with the assistance of the as an integral part of Operation Clean Audit.
All amounts owed by members remain owed until cleared. So even if the member stays or when they leave, they will not leave until that all amounts due by the member have been made good.
whatever methods of termination of service may be, whether by resignation, retirement, whatever, that they remain to, and for collection by the department.
I take it up as the last question. Can you move water to the castle of Kudu? But you see, you are more talking about policies. I thought you wouldn't tell us that why does this member have to have such a huge position? Do you know about this? And why is he dodging? She's working for such a high office.
Chairperson, I do not know the person, General Mari, personally. I'm aware of it, but the reason why this account is bumped up to the amount that it's currently that it's currently reflected in Auditor General's report is not visible to me. We didn't look at individual cases in our investigation to enhance the policy. But what we do acknowledge is that there are a number of internal controls that needs to be checked up, and that is the whole intention of the policy, and also to prevent or to minimize human interaction where people will be required to do specific actions, and if nothing happens, then there is the possibility that there will be a salary deduction if they do not finalize their telephone account on a monthly basis, as is currently stated in our policies.
See, I understand what you're saying. I support what you're saying. But see, this was given to us by the Auditor General himself. So if you don't clearly know that there's something about the information that is not right or wrong, so the Auditor General would print that information from the department and what they've submitted to him. That's how I understand it. That's how he came to say to us. Because you were saying that he gave us the total detail of what is exactly going on within the department. That's the nature of the report. But let's leave it there. Following up at some stage. I'm asking members, I'm asking it to this to my LF. For the processes of Parliament, we need to find a way of finishing the report, and we have just only dealt with one program, which is the administration, and we've got other five or how many others? What other seven outstanding? Now the arrangement had affected us yesterday of how we delegate every the different general or chief of defense to come and give a report. So we'd rely on your office to give us some guidance on how we must prepare our own program to get everybody to come and account for the various departments or for the various divisions. No, no, she hears me. This thing is very powerful. It's technology. Okay. You've got a big voice. That's why I'm such a black. That's why I was missing you. Okay. No, what I was saying, Mamu LLG, we need to get some guidance about the outstanding parts of the report that have not been attended to, so that we could prepare our own parliamentary program. Because it's quite clear that there's some, we've only done one program, which is administration, and we still have to deal with the other. So we considered yesterday, but we need to know from your office now, when can, not now, not to ask now, I'm just saying that if you can think through myself and them to advise each other that when can we get a doctor teaching and when can people can come. It would be nice to have the general coming back to us to come and account. So members would attend to that one, and I'll alert you when we have sort out the doctor teaching with the office of the minister around a particular area of water. In that aspect, one question that is outstanding, the combat readiness, which has been one question that is on the program itself. But maybe within that engagement, I don't know if it's going to be able to answer that question when we take the different decisions to come and account to Parliament itself, and we'll be able to then give a proper report.
Just to say, I would just like to be sure that we cover each line function program, particularly landward defense, air defense, maritime defense, and military help. That we cover them in terms of the annual report, and that we cover them in open committee meetings. I think that's crucial.
Something that I'm not going to work on the teaching. My understanding is that that forms part of the annual report. It doesn't go through the combat readiness. The combat readiness is a totally different topic. But this was a normal activity that has to be reported to Parliament, which are in front of you. And my expectation is that the officials have to say, when they have all the generals to come and interrogate with us around this particular report. I'm correct. I will be talking to the minister to sort out the matter out clearly. Except that we are moving on now. But thanks for your deterrence. But this also is part of you. So yeah, I'm not saying that you must leave our meeting. I'm given the impression that no. General Nkonyan is the one that takes the presentation on this particular one. I'm not saying what you want to say. He did explain to me yesterday, the general, that there was a little bit of a confusion because he's also a general. So everybody thought that generals don't have to come to Parliament yesterday. It's only the secretary. But of course, he's responsible for this one. He had to come back. So that's how he is part of that general as well, trying to explain what is going on at the Cape of Good Hope. What is that?
General Konyan and Ms. Adri Achenbach, they will jointly present the annual report for 089 financial year with respect to the council. The document was distributed as well as the copy of the presentation. But over to General Konyan.
Thank you, Dr. Mr. President, the chairperson of the Portfolio Committee. And honorable members of the committee. I am going to be presenting the annual report of the Council of Good Hope, and I hope this one doesn't have any, you know, attentions, not reminding or other excluded ordinance that doesn't bring forward management of our heritage. And I must say, on a lighter note again, that I think from the side on behalf of the Capital Control Board, I think again we had another successful year in the management and improving the status of the Council. But there are some challenges to put forward with the Council. The scope will cover. I'll have the introduction, which will cover the framework, the regulatory framework, and then from there to the management report, which will cover issues like the events which take place at the castle, some of the responsibilities of the castle management, and then from there I'll go over to the performance information, which will highlight some of the achievements of the castle, the challenges, and some of the support we get from the Department of Defense, and then also highlight some of the strategic objectives which the Carbon Control Board has identified. And then from there, I'll go over to the corporate governance issues, which will highlight issues like the functions of the Carbon Control Board, the policy development and the implementation, and then the audit committee report. And then from there, I'll go over to the HR management, how do we manage the HR component of the council, and then from the summary of the Auditor General report. With regard to the introduction, as I indicated, it's that the council is governed in accordance with the provisions of the Public Finance Management Act of 1999, and also I have to indicate that we are to submit the annual report or present the annual report to the Minister of Defense. And those that according to the PSMA. and then the applicable regulations with respect to the management of the capital. This stems from the constitution of the RSA, the TFMD, the Treasury regulations, the Capital Management Act, and the Defense Endowment and the Property Account Act. With respect to the composition of the capital, the Capital Control Board was established in terms of the Capital Management Act and includes the following representatives. That is, according to the Capital Management Act, the representative from the Department of Defense and the representative from the Army Support Base, Western Cape, the Civil Museum of Cape Town, and representative from CPW, the Cape Town Regional Chamber of Commerce and Industry, the City of Cape Town, the South African Tourism Board, the Western Cape Provincial Legislature. I will indicate later on that that one has yet to come on board. And then we have two Minister of Defense representatives, of which Ms. Attenbach is one of them. And then we've got the Executive Director, which is one of the challenges we're still having. And then with regard to the management report, I will deal with the events which are taking place at the castle, and then the visitors, the number of visitors, and the daily management, the issues. The events which I can highlight with respect, which have taken place over the reporting period, is the Tumbuktu exhibition, the Prison State exhibition, the Cape Town Military Tattoo, which is another one that's just coming in, and then the International Military Chief of Chaplains conferences. Both the Tumbuktu and the Prison State the exhibition were managed by the Civil Museum of Cape Town and utilized the Castle of Kutop as one of the exhibition venues. The International Chief of Chaplains Conference welcoming ceremony was held at the Castle of Kutop on February 1st, 2009, and the Deputy Minister of Defense then, the same welcome delegates and declared the conference and open. In short, he was the one who handled the conference. And then the number of visitors will have an increase, a very slight increase to the previous year. I think this was as a result of the decline of existing the economic activity, which in fact has been taking place worldwide. With regard to the management of the castle, their main focus has been on the management. And but as you can see, most of the people live here who are familiar with the castle, that is one of the biggest challenges the management is the maintenance of the castle. You can see it's really great and it's dilapidating. But this has been the priority of the castle management section, which has made the preventative maintenance their main focus in one of their functions. And then one of the issues which has been very critical in the focus of the Castle Control Board was to the improvement of non-compliance issues. These were non-compliance issues which were identified by the Auditor General in the past years, that is 07, 08, and 06, 08, where we got some qualifications which have been not been resolved, have to do firstly with the audit committee, the composition of the board, the appointment of the executive director and the chief financial officer, the supply chain management policy, which was at that time, it was not in place, it's in place now, and then the risk management policy, which has already been developed. And again, the income tax exemption, which we do have right now. And one of the issues, again, in the management report, which I'd like to highlight, the issue of the transfer of the culture to the Department of Arts and Culture. And this has a lot of relevance to the present portfolio committee, because the previous portfolio committee played a very crucial role in the withdrawal of the repeal bill from Parliament. And it was through the recommendations of the there were some recommendations which you have given to us as the control board by the portfolio committee. And all those recommendations have been addressed. And this had to do with the establishment of the business plan, which we have already developed, and trying to come up with some creative management between plans of achieving financial sustainability, which was in the process of doing it. And then the international best practice, which we have what is in writing process, utilizing all our expertise, that is all our effect in the environment of heritage management. And then the holistic preservation and maintenance of the Castle of Good Hope, that also has been done by the board, and the castle management section has changed the implementation, assisted by the DPW. And then responsible management of the castle as immovable heritage, the asset of which the Appenbach is one of the responsibilities as the heritage senior officer responsible for heritage and endowment and property within the Department of Defense. What I would just highlight here, Honorable Chair, is that some of the events which have taken place after the reporting date, and this has to do with the recommendations of the portfolio committee. And one of those was to obtain the self-sustainability. This was a decision which was made by the board to transfer the head package. It's one of the components of the thing, of the castle, which is one of the revenue generation different elements of the castle, and it's under the army support base in Western Cape. And it was a decision of also supported by the previous portfolio committee that we must start migrating that particular different management of that particular element towards the different under the castle control board, so that we can use it to accomplish the objective of self-sustainability. A comprehensive analysis was completed on the fund, that is the fund and institution policy, assets and personnel and financial statement of the head package, to see whether that decision was viable. And we are in the process, coincidentally, as the chief of logistics, fund and institutions resides under me, and the policy which right now I'm referring to resides under me. And I have to interact with some of the stakeholders of it. The particular one is the acting secretary of defense and the chief of the army, of which the army support is under him. And I think in the near future, we'll see the realization of this particular objective. I must also mention that because the castle, that is one of the had an emergency compliance meeting in the 4th of April to address the outstanding compliance matters raised in previous audits. These matters were addressed, and looking at the time and budget, it is obvious that the Castle Control Board should consider this as a highlight. That is, with the exception of one or two matters, most of the compliance matters were completed successfully. In its report of 2007 and 2008, the annual report of the Castle of Good Hope, the Portfolio Committee on Defense commended the Castle Control Board for an unqualified audit report and a sound financial position. With the exception of the challenges listed below, the Castle Control Board has made a valiant effort to resolve most of the matters of emphasis raised in the previous audit. Now, I'll mention some of the challenges which we have come across. The first one is that one of financial sustainability. And I think that one, until we have have a resolution on the transfer of our taxes, and because that's the only one which I think the castle will have some or will allocate some of the financial debt which it's facing. Until that one is resolved, I think in the near future we're still going to have that challenge of the financial sustainability. Now, with regard to government information, I must also highlight that the main contributor is the Department of Defense. The castle is run by the South African Special Defense personnel from the Army Support Base, Western Cape. Just a correction here, we have the 1.8 million. 1.8 million was the amount paid to in the 07-08. For this particular year it is 2 million. And that can be confirmed with the financial statement of the castle. That is the amount of money of the personnel which has been an amount of money paid to the National Defense Force personnel. And I'm the chairperson of the Cattle Control Board. And again, the subsistence allowance and the travel allowance is paid by the Department of Defense. And the logistics division provides also monthly feedback to the South African National Defense Force in terms of the portfolio committee recommendations. Also, the South African Armed Force has also assisted us in providing procurement specialists. And then the financial division also has deployed some of its personnel who are helping us in developing our financial processes. This is some of the support coming from the Department of Defense. This must be taken within the context that according to the Carbon Control Act, we are, or the castle is supposed to be entirely managed by the board with very legal or no support from the Department of Defense. And then there are some strategic objectives which have which was one of the recommendations by the portfolio committee. There are some strategic objectives which we have summarized in our report. I'll just list them without going into any details. The first one, the strategic objective which was adopted by the board was to preserve and protect the military and cultural heritage of the Castle of Buto. That was the first strategic objective. And then the second one was to optimize the tourism potential of the Castle of Buto. The third one is to optimize the accessibility of the Castle of Good Hope to the public, mainly focusing on the previously disadvantaged state of the people. And then that would be the last one. Then I'll move over to corporate governance. The Castle of the Control Board regards corporate governance as a fundamental contributor to the success of the entity and is fully committed towards ensuring that good governance is practiced in order for the Castle of Good Hope to remain a sustainable and a going concern. Now, I have to mention that we are doing whatever the functioning of the board is managed according to the Castle Management Act. And for the year under review, some of the vacancies in the board existed regarding the executive director, which I mentioned earlier on, and the representative from the Western Cape provincial legislature. And then, in order to ensure a successful implementation of objectives and responsibilities, the Capital Control Board is meeting or has met in the 08-09 financial year, two to three month basis with this meeting, and establish guidelines to the capital management for the execution or to guide it in the execution plan. I must also mention that prior to the withdrawal of the capital management bill during June 2008, members from the Department of Arts and Culture were invited to attend board meetings and to
primarily ensure transparency and also establish continuity with the foundation towards the envisaged transfer of the management of the cluster of Good Hope. They do, up to now, attend our meetings, but not as consistent as it was done prior to the withdrawal of the refilled deal. I must also mention that the attendance of the board meetings was excellent. On average, members meet only one meeting, as it is shown in our annual report. Now, with regard to corporate governance, these were some of the guidelines which were given by the portfolio committee. We managed to develop a human resource management plan. We managed to develop a conservation management plan, a strategic business plan, which I've already alluded to. We also managed to develop a maintenance plan in conjunction with the proposal, in conjunction with the EW, and assisted by some of our specialists from the Department of Defense, which is managed to develop a supply chain management policy and also develop the materiality and significance framework for 09-10. Now, with regard to the human resource management plan, I must indicate that all management principles within the plan reflect the guidelines according to the Public Service Act and are applicable to all members employed by the Customs Control Board. And with regard to members remunerated by the Department of Defense, they are under the human resource management guidelines as applicable to DOD members. And then with regard to the conservation management plan, the main purpose of to guide the institution from a strategic level towards creating a specific site in terms of significance as a cultural site. The draft document has been distributed to lines and for input as to ensure the finalization of a thorough and extensive plan. And with regard to the maintenance plan, DW appointed a company specializing in a conservation architecture for this purpose during the year under due review. And the maintenance plan will guide all future maintenance of facilities. And with regard to the supply chain management policy, a comprehensive supply chain management policy has been established and implemented after approval by the board during the year under review. And the materiality significance framework for 09-10 has also been developed. There is an audit committee report which is attached to our annual report. I won't go through all of it, but what I can highlight that is that as one of the guidelines of the portfolio committee, because we have managed to establish the audit committee with three members, one from the a former or a retired accountant, and then we have two members from EZ, from Museum, and SARA, the South African Heritage Association. And the audit committee has managed to define its own responsibilities, develop its own internal control. Then with regard to internal audit, we are still in negotiations with the Inspector General of the Department of Defense to assist us in the development of the internal audit capabilities. With regard to risk management and other policies, the audit committee was reviewed and evaluated the Auditor General's report for the 1st of May 2008, and marked focus was given to the issues raised and the methods of emphasis. The committee is pleased to report that a detailed risk management plan has been developed and that many new policies and procedures have been developed and implemented by management and the Customs Control Board. The audit committee will continue to monitor both progress and enhancement to these policies and procedures. The human resource management, we publish the statistics according to the public service regulation of 2001. And the council section has 18 members. Of the 10 are 10 as remunerated by the DOT, and then 8 members are remunerated by the Cattle Control Board. And this is the 3 cattle guides, the bookkeeper, a financial clerk, a cashier, assistant, and a museum assistant. And the salaries account for about 10% of our annual income, that is the income of the cattle. And then the last part, the Auditor General report, which I won't go into details that one because I think it does not have any relevance on that one. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Honorable Member, that's the report of the Council of Kuru. The good intention of maintaining it is because we want to put that money in the Castle of Good Hope. Those are the contributors in the past in different military formations. That's why the committee was so vehement when we are supposed to go on to tourist, that we can't turn it into a tourist site, because if it's a tourist site, that is to be forgotten about how military and their contribution to society. So part of the motivation and objective was to say, let's keep it here within the military. Military has done for its own history and start putting it in the Castle of Good Hope, so that as years go by, as we sit down, the portfolio committee can go there and look into the own history and see how it has been working on. People have been involved in World War II, controversies and everything, and they're able to go restore that type of thing within the institution. But if it goes to military, to tourism, becoming tourism, I mean, sport, and people just come in and out and eat, they will be forgotten. That is the real motivation for the portfolio committee to make sure that it doesn't go away from the portfolio committee. But here is the report in front of you, ordinary members of parliament. Is there any question? Like, I want your history data to tell us by the dollar, the veteran, and all those things. Thank you very much, Mr. Jefferson. You know, Comrade Jefferson, and you know, yesterday when I was asking questions, one of the gentlemen that side, he was shaking his head, you know. And I'm not sure he was shaking against me or he was shaking a problem about our account. Sometimes if you look at our account, you find you talk alone, and then I'm not sure. And we must ask because we don't know. We want to know. You know, 135,948 visitors to the country. You know, I just find out this number is a month or a year, and this number is including outside people and South Africans on this one number. And another question, Jefferson. Transfer of the cattle to Department of Art and Culture. I'm not sure. I think it's very important institution. Who is supporting that institution? Because sometimes you find we name people who do a good job for us, you know. Who's the person who established this institution? And why sometimes also name the place with that person who established this? If we are saying it's very important, our heritage, I think the person who established that also, I think it's important for us. Why we don't have time to name that person who established that castle? Our grandchildren to know about this issue. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. the members got a question? Mamu, my bad.
Chairperson, when I look on this, I see this castle has been established for 344 years old. When I look on page 23 on this booklet, it's very disgrace to me to see such a I don't know whether it's an organogram, what is it, but according to the Basic Employment Equity Act, this is really a disgrace to our South Africa. I would like to hear from the general what is the status of their organogram, the approved organogram, and how are they going to address this disgrace that you are looking at, the permanent employees and the contract workers. This is really, I can't even describe how do I feel about this. And also having a concern again, Chairperson, that on the audit committee, they rather go and look for somebody who has retired to become part of this committee. Why is it? Why? Thank you, Chairperson.
Somebody else has got a question? No question.
General, no question. Give us the answer. You see, that's an element.
I'll start with the last one. With respect to the audit committee, why should we go for a retired person? Number one is the first one is that we have to get an independent person, and there are some financial constraints again with regards to that. Most of the people who are on that is most of the accounting firms are very expensive, and as I indicated, one of our biggest challenges here is financial resources. Now, to get audit committee members who are going to be used almost two or three times a year and pay them exorbitant amounts of money, we just can't afford that. Now, the only option we had was that one of getting retired people to come to work in the audit committee. And then with regard to representativity, as I indicated, 80% of the workforce of the castle comes from the Department of Defense, and those people are not paid by the castle revenues. They are paid from the Department of Defense. I must mention that those people are staffed in posts outside of the castle. What they are doing in the castle is above what they are supposed to be doing within the Department of Defense. We don't have the money to employ full-time employees. That's why I indicated that we're trying, one of our programs is to ensure that we maintain financial sustainability. I know you're coming from the perspective of having a balanced or a representative workforce at the castle, but under the circumstances here where you find that we don't have the resources, it's very difficult to even have a representativity listing the program. The 18 employees, those are a casual workers, the keepers. Maybe you might challenge that one, that why don't we listing at least try to attempt to have a representativity at that level. But I think we do have a minimum requirement there. But I think for now, the biggest challenge for the cattle control board has to establish for myself established the colonialists who we are selling, to be honest. I'm not a history expert. I don't know. Maybe I'm not a history expert. I don't know who really established the castle. What I know is that it belongs to South Africans, and I'm tapped to ensure that I preserve that particular heritage. And the issue of, you said it has to be named after that particular person, if I, that's what you recommended. Yeah, I think that will be taken up by the parliament, I think. Which is not my mandate, that one. According to the Act.
No more questions.
A follow-up question, Chairperson. Can the general tell us when he said the codes for this auditing committees? I want to know what were these amounts, so that we can also know how expensive was this. That are the pensioner. The pensioner is cheap. What was the codes? I want to know. This committee wants to know how much was it. So that when you are here as parliamentarians, our duty is to assist the department. If there is a need to do a submission, then we must know how much is it. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Chairperson. General, I'm not satisfied with the racial balances. I understand they are saying that these people are overwhelmed, or they don't belong to the castle, they are not permanent. But as the chairperson of that board, can't you do something about it? It has so many centuries that it has lived, and we are in a new dispensation now, and we have really shocking. Thank you. On the racial balance.
And also, who must help you to get the Western Cape to come and be part of the board? That's it.
Honourable members, I've taken your concern. I must admit, without opening any speech, that when it comes to the representativity within that decision, the workforce, it has not been a priority, because most of the people are coming from the National Defence Force. These are people who are deployed by the National Defence Force. So I think that the focus will be more on the National Defence Force than on the workforce of the castle. And with respect to whether consideration was taken in terms of a balance as in a workforce, not exactly. It wasn't. I'll take that one into consideration as the chairperson of the board. But as I indicated, the main challenge that one of the castle is that ship is sinking. We don't have the funds to run that thing. That's the main focus of the board. But I'm not dismissing your concern. I'll take them into serious consideration. And with regard to the audit committee member, two of those members are not paid. The other one, I'll indicate how much is it paid, or what was the price which was quoted by the other accounting firms. I don't have the figures now, but in due time I'll give you those figures. But the other two members are not paid. They are assisting, and they are just volunteers to be part of the audit committee.
So you are saying that the sector does not help you bringing some money to the institution? Or what's happened?
I
can't help send people to come and work for the castle without also spending some money.
He does his salaries like the manager of the castle, who runs day to day. He's paid by the defense force. Most of the guards, but not most
under the prevailing circumstances to ask for additional funds. I know I'm from logistics. We just don't have the funds. That's why we are pursuing these other alternatives of raising funds from the capability of the castle. The castle, for your information, on a yearly basis, it's raising close to on average 4 million. But those other elements of the castle are not under the castle control board. And this is what we're trying to do now, to bring them under the castle control board so that those funds can be generated and controlled by the castle control board.
So you want Parliament to still help you around that area? You want Parliament to help you around the area?
Any help will be welcome.
Okay, but as long as you don't pay.
I will.
Oh, that's a total moment.
Chairperson, thank you very much. Chairperson, the committee, I understand that Yana was saying that he may go to Parliament, I agree with you. But you are saying you don't know who established these things. I'm telling you, we know. Well, maybe, I'm not sure, but some people, when I'm arriving in Cape Town, 1994, they would say, Jan van der Bent. They would say that. But you know why I'm saying this? Because we are saying it's very important. Once when we are saying that Catholic is very important, which means that's why also we must know where this thing comes from. But if you are saying you don't know, but you know just 344 years, but you don't know. But we must also investigate. If it's not a gentleman, we must investigate to understand. You can't just say 344 years old. Who tell us this? Who know about this 344 years? The person who writes it wrote here also must tell us who was the creator of that church.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'm still on the audit committee. I don't know whether I'm with the general. He is saying the two members of the audit committee are not paid, and the one who is paid is the one who has retired. So we need the quote of this tender. How much was it? Number two, I need the names of who are these two people who are not paid, and who is this one who is a retired person? Thank you.
The retired member is Mr. Strachan, who is the other retired member. And then the other members, as Mrs. Ali from his Eco Museum, and then Ms. B. Kumano from SARA. Those are the two members, Mrs. Ali and Ms. Kumano. Those are not paid. They are just volunteers from the Eco and from SARA. And then the other one of the money part of it, I think I'll come back to you with that one.
But also, you also said just give the full tender when you can. So if you want the full tender, then
yeah.
Of how you got hold of these people.
Oh.
Okay. Seeing that there's no more questions.
Thank you. Thank you, Chairperson. Obviously, it's a comment. Obviously, Bishop John, the report here says the work on the foundation of the castle started in 1665. Obviously, it might have been from Rivet. He was in charge. A member of us, somebody shaking their head. My assumption is that it was during the period of Jan van Riebeeck who arrived in 1652. Now, if this started, the work started in
1665 to the men 13 years later, 1652, 13 years later, after the occupation of this area by Jan van Riebeeck. I don't know who else could have started that. It couldn't have been the British. It couldn't have been Sada Azur or whatever. But my assumption is that it must have been Jan van Riebeeck. And I don't think it makes any difference whether it started by Jan van Riebeeck or by anybody else. The question I would like to ask the chairperson is most probably the castle all these years was run and maintained by the Department for Defense all these centuries. And I think they've been doing a very good job. The castle itself is a very well-known institution, respected by everybody, especially in the Western Cape. And anybody coming to South Africa, among other things, wants to see Cape Parliament. He or she wants to go to Table Mountain and the castle. Now, recently, it's Robben Island also. So these are four very important institutions, if I may call them, here in South Africa, which are very important, which are attractive to many people coming from overseas and so on and so forth. I don't know if, I mean, the Department for Defense, sorry for my voice, has been running this institution in particular, the castle, so well. What motivated the department transferring this to art and culture? Why was it transferred? Was there a demand from the Department for Art and Culture that we want to take that over and run it? I mean, GOG has been running this for years, for centuries, man. I don't know whether one can get an answer for that. What made us to transfer this to DAC?
Now I understand what the general said. He don't know. Because I was asking a question. I was saying very much that the man answered me. I was saying 100-something thousand visitors is the South African or is the abroad the South African. He didn't answer. And the Mlangi answering me, that is very important. Maybe that's why my leader said he don't know some other things. And but he must also investigate. We want to understand. I don't know. I don't know. That's why I'm asking you. But I know you also, you are not a God. You learn other things to us. That is very important. I know that. But the Mlangi was that. Because why am I asking this question? I came from Limpopo province. Didn't he know about this? And when we went back home, we must also tell the people to come visit if they don't know. Because if you look, especially we as the black people, generally, sometimes we didn't have the opportunity to know about this other thing, you know. Now we must also try to tell our people also to come to see that is very important. That's why I want to know who is the person. But this gentleman next to me, he was shaking his head like the other gentleman that's right. When the Mlangi was saying, maybe he can explain us who created this country. Because if he said he's a head, you know, then he can maybe explain us that gentleman that's right.
Who's the gentleman that shaking his head there? Which one that's right?
The young one.
From the two. Don't do that in the community. And Irma, don't shake your head when the older men ask you. You have an answer?
I know what the answer is not, Mr. Chair. It's I'm remembering school history. I know that Van Riebeeck was gone within 10 years, so it was whoever the following governor was.
None of your historians. No, please, don't start giving history also wrong. You don't know, please.
Van Riebeeck was an utterly useless governor and wasn't capable of building a castle. And hence, I think Simon van der Stel built the castle.
You know that history, so please.
Yes, no, thank you. This is the one question which I did not answer. That has to do with the visitors. And the biggest component of the visitors is the school children, the foreigners, so that is a tourist, and then local, so that is the South African. As I indicated in our strategic objective, was that we wanted to attract more school children. And then when it comes to that one of the history of the castle, there is the museum in the castle. It has all the history. But I didn't want to go into that one of the history because, history depends who you are listening to. And you'll find that what I'm saying is always going to be, again, debated by some other person. Even with the history we have at the castle, you'll find that the perspective, the different perspectives, from the colonialists, from the local people, and all those things. So as a military person, I don't want to delve into that. Hence, I said, I'm not an expert in history, which is true, I'm not. But if you listen to the historians, which are there at the museum, definitely you'll get a degree of truth about exactly who established that one and whom, for what purpose, you'll get that one. And then with regards to why was it decided to move, migrated to arts and culture. There were various reasons. The first one was finance, and then the second one, the core business. From our perspective within defense, it was seen that the management of cultural heritage to the best of the potential, which is what the culture is not within our core business. Our business is to defend the country, not to promote the heritage that is in a site, and then Department of Culture would do better that one because that is their core business. That was the whole reasoning behind from the defense side. And from the Department of Culture, it was that this is an asset and they can manage it better. But now there were some debates, especially from the historians, the defense or military historians, who said that I think it's better managed within, I think that emanated from the portfolio committee, that it's better managed within the Department of Defense. As you argued, you are not the only one, the honorable member. They felt that the defense, because this is mostly military history, it can be better managed within the defense force. But I think right now there was some interaction between our minister and the minister of culture were waiting exactly what's going to happen. But in short, that was the history of the debate as to the transfer over to arts and culture.
Sir Jeff, can I thank you, Mr. Chair? Thank everybody that has come and been able to listen to us part today. And with the ministerial staff also that has come, I want to thank you for coming around. As we always say, that as parliamentarians, we always want to be rigorous and do some of our work, but it's not with bad intention. It's to try to get to the bottom of issues and to see how do we assist you in trying to make a better contribution. I also want to thank the people from PMG, all the different staff members that are here,
a good job that are doing. We are closing the meeting. Very much.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Just one outstanding issue, whether we could get a mandate from the Portfolio Committee to approach the Minister to ask for an investigation into the supply chain procurement, and also whether we could get an undertaking from her that we could see that report of the Inspector General of the investigation that he's doing into the Origin Exchange contract.
See, I've not had the sense of any member of parliament that proposed what the initial suggestion was put forward, so I took it under either agreement in the portfolio committee. The detail of how we interact about it between ourselves and the minister, of how she was dealing with the matter itself. So I took it that we are in agreement. Can Mandy has captured us and we'll work for it. But can I continue thanking everybody and say, we're finished now with that. We will work out the details of the other interactions around the annual report. Thank you.